Hi, everybody. This is Joanne with Read Science, where we like to talk to authors about what they do and how they do it, along with my co-host Jeff Schomeyer. And today we happen to be talking to three editors of a book of a topic of high importance to me and to anybody who reads science online. And this book is called Science Blogging. Oops, my camera's not catching it. The Essential Guide. And you can tell it's been handled a lot. You might want to talk to your publisher about this cover, you know? Maybe I have greasy fingers or something. But yeah, I think there's sweet tea on it and things too. So anyway, so I'm really excited to have you guys here because when I got a hold of this book, I thought, well, I've had a blog for some time and I do a lot of microblogging and now I do the Read Science Online. I thought, wow, this is going to be great. And when I read it, it was like, this is like science online in a book. And for those out there who are watching, who don't know what Science Online is, it was a meeting for people who talked and shared about science online that was held for several years. And I know I went to more than half of those. So, but anyway, so today our guests are Bethany Brookshire, Christy Wilcox, and Jason Goldman. And I have the great honor of introducing both Bethany and Christy, and Jeff will take over and introduce Jason. Did I call you Jeff? I hope I said Jason. So anyway, so first let me talk about Christy, because I'm really excited about Christy, because she's got a book coming out later this year
Yes.
called Venomous, so you're coming back on the show when that comes out, okay?
Absolutely.
Promise.
I promise.
Okay, Christy Wilcox is a science writer and social media specialist. She is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Hawaii, jealous, where she uses molecular biology techniques to study venoms. She is also a writer at Discover Magazine Blogs, where she authors the blog Science Sushi. You can find her website at christywilcox.com and on her Twitter at Nerdy Christy, because I was trying to say Nerdy Christy so quickly, and this is how I remember, you know, sort of being introduced to you was on Twitter at a time when, you know, science bloggers were flocking to Twitter, but there were still few of us, so it was easy to get to know everyone, right? So why don't you say hi quickly so everybody sees you there.
Aloha. How are you guys doing?
Hello. Okay, so Bethany, who used to not say her name in public, sort of Voldemort-like, and
I hope I'm slightly less evil. I'm not a Slytherin by nature.
yes, I don't think so. But you talked on occasion about topics that maybe polite company didn't want to talk about. So under your Twitter name, SciCurious, that was your pseudonym, and you had a very, very interesting blog for quite some time there, and it's still interesting. You've just sort of shifted where you do this at, right? So, so Bethany Brookshire is an award-winning science writer at Science News and Society for Science and the Public. She runs a SciCurious blog and manages social media for Science News for students, which I check like at least once a week. She is also the guest editor of the Open Lab Anthology, The Best Science Writing Online 2009. And your new job has got you placed in Washington, D.C.
Do you like
So
my
after
cubicle?
your, yes, I'm happy they let you do this from your work. So her blog is at scicurious.org, and you can find her on Twitter at scicurious. So say hi to everyone officially.
Hello.
Yeah.
And so now we go to Washington, D.C., where I'm with Bethany so that I can introduce Jason, who's in California. And I want to say it's not really going to be guys versus gals today. It just was my turn to introduce Jason Goldman, described as cognitive scientist, animal behavior researcher with a PhD from the University of Southern California, and a science writer based in Los Angeles. He has a long list of contributions to magazines that will be familiar to everyone in our audience. He writes about animal behavior, wildlife biology, conservation, and ecology. and I liked learning from his website that his dissertation research looked at, quoting, developmental psychology and animal cognition by seeing what happens to chickens when they grow up in virtual reality. Continuing to quote, now he's completely obsessed with mountain lions, squirrels, raccoons, whale sharks, and harpy eagles, but chickens still have a special place in his heart, close quote, as they should, I would add. His chapter in science blogging is called Communicating Science as a Graduate Student. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you for having us. I'd say that chickens do continue to respect them are probably the messiest, dirtiest, smelliest animals in the laboratory.
Yes, but they're sort of sweet in their stupidity, I always thought.
Oh, they're not so stupid.
Yeah, don't you insult chickens in front of Jason.
I am not insult chickens. My grandparents had a farm. I may have been the last generation to grow up with people who knew something about farms, and so I have enjoyed the company of chickens occasionally and helped my grandfather pull their heads off, but I don't really need to relive that. Okay. I get to start the conversation today, which I'm happy to do, and I decided I wanted to start either at the end or at the top and do a sort of top-down thing with themes identified by Paige Ajaro, who wrote the afterword to Science Blogging. And she was talking about how, in a relative short time, she feels that online science community is showing potential for increasing the reach of minority voices, which I think is an important point. And she sees science blogging as growing up, somehow, moving from earlier roles in critiquing science journalism being a partner in science journalism, and that the type of stories that get told is changing. So, two quotations that I thought embodied that. One, she says, science bloggers have decided that they can do much more than play second fiddle to mainstream science journalism, and their efforts are paying off. And she also said, those participating in science today take science blogging seriously. And so the question is, and let's start, where should we start? Bethany, I think, since we're in the same city. The question is science blogging maturing? Where has it been? What does that mean? Easy question here.
I would say that it is maturing somewhat, much like many other forms of blogging. It's now, I would not say that, you know, we used to think of blogging as something that you did in your pajamas covered in crumbs in your basement. And now it may not be something that people do as a profession, but it is something that you can certainly do professionally, like in a professional capacity.
What sort of age should we give it? Is 20 years or so sounding like close to that number?
I would say the oldest blog that I personally know of is 2006, so I wouldn't give it more than that's the oldest science blog I know of, is 2006.
I think a little bit older, 15 years.
Maybe 2004?
Yeah, I think there were a couple blogs that we would now call science blogs that at the time perhaps might not have self-identified in a way. Yeah. That were probably in the very early 2000s, 2002, 2003.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that sounds about right. So, because I started in 2007, 2008, and that obviously I knew what a blog was, a science blog was. So they had to be around for a few years.
My first internet days had to do with web pages that were very crude and things in the early 90s when there were bulletin boards, but no such thing as blogs. As we're going through this question, I wanted to ask the question, can we see a show of hands of people who actually remember what civilization was like before the internet was invented? I do.
I do.
Okay. I don't remember before I had it, like in my house.
I remember before I had it.
I don't.
Yeah, I come from a time when, electric pencil sharpeners were important things.
Well, I grew up with a programmer for a father, so I think I jumped on the internet pretty early.
Yeah.
Even for
but so continuing, what is maturity doing to science blogging? And keep in mind, the other half of the question was, is it increasing minority participation? Is it giving a better venue for minority voices, which is a big hope for many of us. You're on my screen right now, Christy. So go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. No, I do think that maturing is, as Bethany sort of mentioned, has to do with becoming more professional, and whether or not you're doing it in your pajamas, I think that the content has become more professional, and the way in which people view blogs has become more professional. And so bloggers aren't just these sort of ranting voices that nobody cares about. They're becoming key voices, and some of them are journalists, and some of them, you know, write just as quickly and easily for a blog as they will for the New York Times. So they're not changing the quality of their writing just because it's on a blog or something like that. And same with scientists. I mean, we're not changing the quality of our writing as scientists. We might be changing the tone and the way we write it so that it's more understandable to a general audience. But in terms of quality, our journal articles and our blogs are the same level of quality. So you're getting that professionalism put into the blogging sphere.
But real journalism started happening in there someplace. Oh, was it accidental? How many? There's some people someplace who made a decision to try to bring up the standard, right?
I mean, I think there was a time around the time the three of us were all sort of really getting into blogging, 2008 and 2010, something like that. When science blogs were thought in a way as an antidote to more mainstream science journalism, and I think it was a time when we were worried about the way things like vaccines were being covered, the way things changed. Not that we're still not concerned in some ways about those things, but blogs, I think, were thought of as sort of a more responsible or a more expert-heavy response to that kind of coverage. And I think now, you know, as mainstream outlets have come to recognize the audience that those science bloggers were getting, many of those bloggers have been incorporated into that world. And I suspect as a result of that, you've seen more of this professionalization that we're talking about. You've seen more of the kind of writing we might identify as journalism on those blogs. But I think it's important to point out that there's still a very large swath of the science blogosphere that is still you know, writing their independent blogs either on small networks or on WordPress, Blogspot, and you know, because science bloggers are not just covering science content, they're also writing about what life is like.
Right.
Which tend to be written more by active, you know, scientists and researchers, not people like me, who have left research to do science writing full time. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer is yes. In some ways, it has become more professionalized, but in some ways, those sort of independent bloggers out there on the internet doing their things are still very much an important part of that ecosystem.
But you'd also say, I'm sorry, Bethany, I'm right there, but you'd also say that the journalism that's happening is happening differently, too, than the way science journalism used to happen, I think. There are changes and things. Go ahead, Bethany.
Well, what I was going to say is one of the things that it's really important to keep in mind is that blogs are a platform. Like, there's something you use to put content on the internet. What that content is up to you, your editor, your publication. You know, so now, for example, the New York Times has blogs. National Geographic has blogs. Science News has blogs. They are, in many ways, essentially journalism. Sometimes they have a more personal tone, or they have, you know, they take more of a wider context view. There's all sorts of ways in which they differentiate themselves. But in the end, you know, whether a blog is professional has to do with who's writing it and not the fact that it's a blog or not.
Mm-hmm. Was it the professionalism or some other quality that made us start calling some of this journalism rather than what other derisive term was used before that? But
I mean, I would say it has to do with whether you're doing journalism on your blog.
Yeah.
You know, are you getting out the comment? Are you looking for the context? Are you reading, you know, critically?
So as as someone described, we bloggers sort of gave up snarky commentary in a bid to get noticed and started writing. Well, journalism.
I wouldn't say they gave up.
So I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe you haven't read my blog lately. I definitely haven't given up snarky commentary.
Well, I
think we have to remember that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think we have to remember that journalism is an act, and blogs are software, and those things sometimes overlap, and sometimes they do not. And just and also, I think there's a difference between tone, which you can have snark with, and journalism, which is again a sort of a way of it doesn't entirely overlap with tone, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think you can have something be snarky journalism, and it depends on how you've researched it and how you've, all of that side of the journalism, and rather than...
Newspapers sold a lot of copies with gossip columnists with very sharp tongues 100 years ago, too. So that also is nothing new. I have some more on this, Joanne, but let me give you the mic for a little bit.
So, what I was going to say is that my blog originally started out, as an extension of being an educator, someone who's enthusiastic about science and thought, well, I could share some of this with the wider public. And then some people started off blogs as, let me tell you what's wrong with this paper, or let me expound more on what's in this paper, because you're an expert in that area and you could give some insight. And then there are people who started blogs to talk about the culture of science. So when I look at the fact that there are 26 different topics in this book, some of them talk about, the different ways to use blogging. Some talk about how to earn money doing blogging. Some talk. does someone maybe one of you want to run through some of the chapter titles and contributions, because I would really, since we can't invite all 26 people here, I would love though that they all get their due. Maybe not all of them, but maybe a good portion of them get their due as to what someone can expect when they pick up this book. Is it just how to? Is it history? Is it,
I think what we really strive to do was make it all of that. So we wanted to have a bit of how to for people who are really new to it and really don't know what they're doing. So there is a chapter on how to set up a blog, just how to even do it. How do you, or there's like Danielle Lee's chapter and Zen Fox chapter, which sort of debate whether or not you should be on a network, or should you be independent. Melanie Tannenbaum's chapter on how to deal with comments and trolls and what do you do when you have people that, really hate what you're writing and how do you try to keep that comment section in line. So I think there's that sort of how-to kind of section, but then there's also, a lot of other chapters about, what's it like to blog as a grad student, like Jason's chapter, and, what are the concerns that are special to grad students, and we also have ones on journalism, for journalists, or for, tenure-track faculty, and how do you incorporate blogging into a career that isn't just blogging, or Bethany's chapter on how to make a career out of blogging, essentially, and how to get paid.
I wouldn't say it was how to make a career, but it was how to get paid. get paid a lot.
So while we're on the money, let's talk about the dreaded exposure topic that I think all of us have experienced of, hey, why don't you write for us? You will get exposure, but no pay,
Or Bethany, I think you can
because your chapter was a little bit on that, wasn't it?
It was. My usual response now when people ask me to write for exposure is that people die of exposure.
Me too.
Or you can get arrested for exposure. That happens. I would say it's a very delicate balance for young writers, young bloggers who want to get their names out there, because the reality is people aren't going to hire you unless they know what you can do. And so there has to be a certain amount of writing that is not necessarily done for exposure, but done for yourself, so that you have clips out there, so that you have things that people know you did them, and this is what they can expect from you in terms of quality and context and et cetera. But I also think it's very important that people, especially young writers, get paid. And that's, you know, people a lot of times say, oh, well, if you love it, you should do it for free, which is not really fair. You know, why do we expect people to do what they love for free? So, you know, it's still work. It still takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And, you know, it's not all horses and ponies and, you know. So I think it's very important to consider that when you start writing. Consider where it is you want to put your stuff that you're writing just for yourself and for practice versus, you know, where you pitch things and how you pitch blog posts. And, you know, when you pitch them, because the thing about pitching a lot of more bloggy topics is you need to do it now. You know, it's very timely. So I think that's something that needs a lot of thought from young writers. You don't want to put it all out there for free. You need to think about what you're going to put out there for free and what you're going to say, no, I need to send this somewhere to get paid.
Because you did counsel judicious exposure, because even as soon as I finished writing down, I will now respond, people die of exposure, because that's a good answer. Then you went on to explain all the things that you did for free at the beginning in order to get exposure, because that's right, you have to get into it somehow, you have to develop the portfolio that everyone wants to see, right? But you gave us some guidelines and some ideas for how to do that judiciously and with a direction toward making it count for something, which is what we're really after, right? We do have to do some things for free.
Right. And, you know, it used to be for, well, and it sometimes still is, you know, for people who are going into science journalism, many of them go and get master's degrees or certificates in science journalism or science communication or just degrees in journalism. And a lot of that helps you build network. It helps you write clips. It helps you get those first few pieces out there that give you the portfolio that can allow you to go places and get paid. For people who are coming from the science world or from other worlds where they don't have that opportunity, a certain amount of judicious writing for free probably has to happen. It's not fair. Yeah. I wish the world were not this way.
I hope people are hearing the things you're talking about. Sorry, because as a scientist with pretensions towards, you know, journalism, let's be honest, I like the fact that you mentioned there are the people who come from a journalism side and get a degree, perhaps, and things, and develop a career through that path, and also the people who come from the science side, and that both of these can meet in the middle and both can be very credible. I think I like for people to hear that, especially me. So if you
Well, and all three of us are scientists turned writers or scientists turned journalists, not journalists from the get-go.
Right. Well, and I've even had to deal with people saying, oh, you're a writer, you're a journalist. I'm like, no, I've never said that. Someone else is putting that name. You know, I've always said, always, I'm an educator. Yes, I have to write. But yeah, so I always laugh about that. And so, you know, and people often say to me, let's talk about writing a book. People say, oh, you should write a book. And I go, why? Why? Nothing is dying inside of me to get it, like screaming, I must get out. And they go, but you've got a lot of Twitter followers. And I said, last time I checked, when I read a book, it's about how good is that book. You know, but so for you, Christy, though, you felt like I have something to say that I could write about in a book. So let's hear about going from blogging to book publishing, which Brian Switek, who has been a guest on our show, wrote about in this book.
Yeah, well, for me, it was definitely it was a very direct path, I should say, because I had a book agent approach me because of my blog, and he said, you should write a book because you write great stuff in a blog, and I think a lot of it would translate well in a book. And so that's what got me started on writing a book. I I kind of had it somewhere in the back of my mind that that's something I wanted to do eventually, but I certainly wasn't planning it or really pursuing it at the time that it was basically offered to me or proposed to me, which happened to be right when I was writing my dissertation, too. So I wrote two books at the same time, which was quite an entertaining process. But I think what was nice about having a blog, and Brian does talk about this in his chapter, is that it allowed me to sort of explore certain themes and certain ideas. So there are sections of my book that have, you know, at least relate to previous blog posts that I've tried or attempted to write, and so pulling from that sort of content, and also playing with my tone just in general. So being able to try to write long-form posts and chapter-length posts. I mean, one of my more recent posts on the blog now is an 8,000-word story about, you know, hunting for a mushroom in Hawaii. So, I mean, that sort of, they played off of each other and worked together. So I was able to take, you know, blog writing and turn it into book writing, but also book writing and turn it into blog writing.
That's great. That's, you know, and you think about how many people we know who started with blogging and have written books, and this includes Ed Yong, who it took him long enough, but he'll have a book out in August. But he's been blogging and writing excellent stuff for so long, and it was like, when's the book coming? So how about you two, Bethany and Jason? Any books in the near future, you think?
Jason?
I hope so. I'm proposing now as it happens. So, yes, I certainly hope so.
I like to say that the only book I have in my soul is torrid romance novels. but
with a scientist in the lead.
Yes!
Why not?
I think there's a market for that.
Actually, those exist. Yeah. I'm not going to tell you how I know that, but they exist. Yeah.
I have written a book, but it is fiction and not things, and it comes closer to torrid romance. But
so, yeah, okay, so actually, before Jeff says he has another question, but I was just thinking today, I shared on Facebook about Deep Sea News just posted something about, hey, let's name that new polar vessel, scientific vessel, Bodie McBoatface. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this kind of stuff 10 years ago would get no traction. No one would know about it. No one could comment. Like, yeah, here's why I think we should name it Bodie McBoatface. You know, kids would know about it. Kids would go, I know that science ship. It's called Bodie McBoatface, right?
Well, so, I just started a hashtag called Machine Goes Ping, which is about the funny things that scientists name their research equipment.
Yes.
So go contribute. I have an HPLC.
I have to remember what I had in the list. But
I actually think it is brilliant.
Totally. I mean, Bodie McBoatface, I would ride in that boat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, and like they said, oh, it would have a Twitter account with a personality just like the, you know, the space rovers and things like that. So, so just looking at, you know, the history of, you know, how we used to get our information, now because of blogs, we can read small things like this, someone's opinion on something as trivial yet important as this. You know, because it could have a big impact, you know, how people see science. And so why don't we just sort of turn this question into something like, what do you guys think it has happened to the general understanding of science thanks to science blogs? And any sense of, you know, has the general public become more informed? Are they more confused? Do you guys have any sense of that?
Is science any friendlier than it used to be, I think?
Is it friendlier? Is it more accessible? I'd like to think so.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of how I feel. I'd like to think that science blogs have personalized science a little bit more, so that it's not just, you know, straight-up newspaper-style news stories, that it is scientists, you know, expounding about their excitement about something they've done, whether it's, you know, before the papers come out or after, or people just expressing their excitement and interest in science in a more personal way.
I agree. How about you guys? Do you have any other additions to that thought?
I would say I want to think that we have kind of made people see scientists more in a personal way, but I'd have to see the data.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I like data, but also because we, all three of us, are kind of, we formed our love of science in a time when we had the internet. So I can't say personally what that was like before because I was five.
Right.
I would need to see the data.
Yeah, and so this kind of study probably needs to be done sooner rather than later before everybody who experienced science before the internet is gone.
I don't have much longer.
I think we are seeing changes with things like the draw a scientist test, where they tell kids to draw what a scientist looks like or whatever. And I think slowly we are seeing changes. And I'd like to think that has to do with science blogs and the internet. It also might just have to do with the internet in general and people having more access and more effort being put into, showing minorities who do science, showing women doing science, all those sorts of things that, people might not have seen before the internet.
Right, and I mean, the Draw a Scientist, I actually recently blogged about this. The Draw a Scientist test has actually really changed with regard to demographics, in that more and more people draw female scientists over the last couple of decades, and that kind of started trending up in the 80s. And, I'd like to think that's due to science blogging, but there's lots of other factors, and we can't really differentiate that, because, for example, a lot more women did become scientists. Mm-hmm. So we have them. They are going and doing outreach in science classrooms. There's a lot of that. I mean, it's tough to say, really pinpoint what's driving that change.
Mm-hmm. A lot more did, although there, women are still a significantly underrepresented group in science. But maybe that progress also is something that is very slow and the long game. Something that that we said a little bit ago, it was Christy, I think, reminded me that another one of my perennial topics, I think Joanne recognizes all of these now, is about storytelling, really. And in the chapter by Marie-Claire Shanahan called Blogging as a Resource for Science Education, I was very interested. I have two notes that she mentioned. One, and I'm quoting now, one research team asked high school students to explain what they look for when they choose to read an article about science. They said they were more interested in pieces that were creative, that used metaphor, analogy, and poetic language to help explain concepts, than in ones written in a more formal, traditional journalistic tone. And that exposure to science news must contain context, something that traditional outlets rarely have time for. So before, we were looking at how journalism and blogging, or how blogging has come closer to journalism in some, respectable space. But now I'm interested in how blogging has opened up journalism to more narrative. And Joanne and I have seen this, I think, in some of the books that are more, the way they tell their science story is getting a lot more personal, a lot more narrative driven, more imaginative fiction at times in the nonfiction, creative nonfiction. There are a lot of ways that are more narrative based. So the simple version of that is, Bethany, I'm seeing you right now. How important is narrative in telling a good science, story?
I would say that, everyone loves a story. That's, what we really gravitate toward. In fact, I highly recommend our chapter by Ben Lilly on storytelling in science. Yep. He's got a whole chapter on it. And he, has created helped create the entire podcast, The Story Collider, which is focused on scientists telling stories. I think stories are extremely important, and I think that people have come to realize that more. But I would also hasten to add that not all blogging needs to be a story. For example, I would talk about Rosie Redfield's blog, which is which was used a lot during the arsenic life thing, where they thought they'd found life that used arsenic, and you know, she managed to disprove this, and it was a lot of data. There was not a lot of story there, and there was a lot of data. And now there's a lot of scientists who are just putting data on their blogs, you know, really working in that space. And that's also a very valuable contribution. So I think there's room for all different types.
Although even if you talk about the data at all, you can talk about it and tell a story about it. Even if it's not storytelling as such, there's still a sense of that. And I was going to mention Ben Nola, who gave us some very good advice, and I have made a note of his advice for how to write a good story: begin in the middle, end at the end. And those are both thoughtful advice pieces. Anyway, so narrative, Christy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
How
do you tell good stories?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. What, you think I know? I think it's about doing what, for me anyway, part of it is doing what feels right. And mm-hmm. sort of writing, because you're telling your story, and it's your story. I mean, so it has to come from you. You can't necessarily just read all these books about, you know, story structure and how to, you know, like, what shape a story should be, right? You can try all you want, but if it's not coming naturally from you, it's not going to come out as a story. So I think, I mean, you can get better at storytelling, certainly, by reading, you know, how to write a story or all of that, but part of it is really just being true to who you are and to how you feel the story should be told.
This is one of our chapter writers' advice that or observation that blogging is a platform and not a style.
Yes.
And you need to find your natural way to tell an engaging, enthusiastic story that's coming from your own interests, right?
From your own interest and for your own audience. I mean, what a, you know, PhD level scientist is going to find an interesting story may not be the same as what a high mm-hmm. school student finds as an interesting story, or what a nurse finds as an interesting story, or any of these other sort of potential demographics that you're trying to speak to. So I definitely do think that part of it is the great thing about blogging, in my opinion, is that you have this complete control or near complete control of style and tone and all of and content. At least, I mean, maybe some of the platform blogs that, you know, are a little bit more narrow in that. But when it comes to just you start a blog on the internet, it's your blog. You can do what you want with it.
Right. And this sort of brings us to, you know, audience. Like, you mm-hmm. know, one, how do you determine who your audience is? Two, I mean, I love the fact that there's something for everybody. Mm-hmm. Right? Something for everybody. There's no doubt. And that journalism and news stories just could not do. They were just sort of aiming for this, you know, interested reader, you know, interested, highly motivated science reader. But now we can reach young kids, we can reach, you know, as you say, nurses, we can reach computer scientists, you know, who want to continue to talk like they talk at work, and they want to read about that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think, so let's talk a little bit about knowing who your audience is. This is part of that how-to in the book, right? And I remember this becoming, and I, you know, people would ask me, who's your audience? And I'll be like, well, based on the emails I get, I'd say it's a lot of middle school and high school girls, and then some of their teachers and their aunts who go, I told my niece about you, you know. You know, so that was before the age of analytics, right, was feedback. So Matt Shipman wrote an chapter in the book. So someone wants to comment about figuring out who your audience actually is, and yeah, should you keep trying to build that audience or expand it or not expand it?
Jason, you want to take that while we still got you?
Yes, while Jason's
sorry,
here.
Sorry, I keep falling off. Yeah, I wish I had a good answer for that question. I think You can use analytics to get at certain demographic questions, certainly. But, you know, for me, knowing, like, geographically where someone is or what browser they're using to access my stuff. Like, that's not personally useful. At least if I haven't figured out how to make it personally useful. So all I can do is try to engage with the people who leave comments or follow me on social media, and try to sort of get a qualitative sense of who those people are. And I'm not sure. I hope that there are very smart people who are sort of thinking about these questions and developing tools to help people like us solve them. But I do not yet know what those tools might look like.
I worry that all the people developing those tools work for Facebook, though.
Probably. I think one of the greatest things that I've seen when it comes to determining who your audience is already, I mean, part of it is a conscious decision. I mean, when you decide, you know, am I going to use swear words? So my mm-hmm. boyfriend, for example, Jake Bueller, has a blog, and I'm not going to say the name because it is a swear word in it, but stuff you didn't know about biology. And so he's automatically targeted a certain audience level. Right, he's saying this is not for children. right off the bat, you know, we're definitely having a certain demographic at minimum at this blog. So there's a certain amount that's conscious. But what I love is what Ed Yong and a few others have started doing, which is they just ask. So they put up a blog post that says, "Hey, everyone out there, comment about who you are. I want to know who's reading this blog." And so, I mean, there's a very direct way in that sense of getting a sense of who your audience is, or at least who you have currently, by just asking them to engage with you.
But a big promise of the internet, in addition to letting minority voices be heard better, is that you can reach scattered audiences, niche audiences, much better and turn them into a cohesive audience a lot better than you ever could when you had to be in the same place at the same time. Mm-hmm. Your boyfriend is going for that, and your blogs probably depend on that sort of demographic idea. Oh dear, mm-hmm. Wasn't a question, but
yeah. Well, and you know, and I find the only time I ever need to know who my demographic is when someone asks me, "Who's your demographic?" And then I have to wonder, why do they care? Right? But some people do care. They go, look at all the followers on Twitter. Who follows you? So I can make that happen too, right? They want advice. How do I make this, happen for me?
But the point then, Joanne, would be that you're not really targeting a particular group, so you don't need to measure whether you're reaching that group. Instead, you're doing what you do based from your enthusiasm, and you develop a community, and that's my thing into what Carl Zimmer had to say, who wrote that blogging has taken us from one-way to two-way communication between science writer and science reader. And he thinks that, he's right, that science blogging involves a lot of community and interaction. That's what makes it work. And that's a pretty new thing, right? Even this is still evolving, but that is one way that writing for the New York Times science page is a lot different. Is that it doesn't depend, his reputation there may depend on it, but the success of a blog really depends on developing a community or finding a community and interacting with them, yes, especially on Twitter, it seems.
Yeah. I think social media and community has, well, the success of other forms of social media, and whether you want to call it microblogging or whether you want to call it whatever, things like Twitter and Facebook have changed how blogs work. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first got started, it wasn't a big deal. It was sort of like, yeah, I guess you can put your blog on Facebook. Or like, you know, like, okay, you know, yeah, there's this Twitter thing if you're interested. It wasn't like a, oh my goodness, what do you mean you're not on Twitter? How do you even get your blogs out there if you're not on Twitter? So I do think that you're definitely seeing a shift in how people network and how people communicate, even within the blogging community. It used to be all about comments. Now there are certain places that aren't even allowing comments.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And, you know, for pros and cons, I mean, there are certainly reasons why you might not want to allow comments, and there's research to back up some of those reasons. So, I mean, there's, it's I think, what's really interesting about blogging is it's still always dynamic. Mm-hmm. It's never settled into just like, oh, this is what it is now. You know, there's constantly changing, you know, what the types of blogs are, what the tones of blogs are, what the how you share them, how you communicate with them. I mean, everything is constantly in flux.
Right.
Is the fact that blogging, science blogging, happens in a community and that's what makes it go, is this an end point of development or is this a beginning point for new development? You have to speculate now.
I think it's a beginning. I think we're always at the beginning. I don't foresee science blogs just stopping existing. So in that sense, we're at the beginning of, or maybe the middle, but you know, we're at a beginning of something, and where it goes from here is you know.
This is science communication growing into the tools that are available to it and finding very productive ways of doing it.
Yeah, great. Let's transit to this idea of how we have grown professionally thanks to blogs, thanks to social media. Okay, so I'm sure all of us have had things picked up by the typical media. You know, we covered something and they happened to see, ooh, that looks like a good story, so let's take this now and let's call Christy and get her on, you know, CNN or whatever, right? To be the professional commenting on this. So all of you have had experiences like this. So have at it. Let's talk about things that have happened thanks to blogging, thanks to social media, that would not have happened otherwise if you were just sitting in your lab or in the field, I should say.
Well, I would say, first of all, I'd still be in the lab because I'm not anymore. I think it's... I think starting a blog was the thing that ended up launching my career transition. I would not be a writer now if I hadn't, you know, taken those first tentative steps on WordPress back in 2008. So I think there's certainly that.
Yeah. Jason, are you there enough to answer?
Yeah, I mean, the same is absolutely true for me as well. If I hadn't started that blog back in 2009, I certainly would not be where I am today. Just at the basic level, you know, like at that time, I don't think I knew that you could have a career as a science communicator, mm-hmm. as a science writer. You know, let alone all the other cool things I've been able to do because of it. All the other ways in which blogging and just online science communication has been a platform for other things. You know, I don't. None of it would have been possible if I hadn't started that blog way back when.
Yeah.
And Christy, you've been on TV many, many times.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to fathom what my life would be like without blogging in it. I mean, it's changed a lot of what I wouldn't have a book coming out if I wasn't a blogger. You know, I wouldn't. I certainly wouldn't have been on TV for anything. You know, I. It's so hard to even imagine. I'm not even sure I would have pursued a PhD because I started blogging before I went for my PhD.
Oh wow.
And part of the reason I started blogging was this frustration with what I was doing. Not that I didn't like what I was doing, but that I felt like there was a whole field of science that I was not a part of anymore, and I really wanted to get back, you know, more of the ecology and more of the biology. And so when I started blogging, it allowed me to sort of talk about science and do, you know, write about science that I wasn't doing personally at the time. I was in the biomedical field, so I'd sort of moved away from my ecology roots. And I think getting that taste of it really riled me up and was like, no, you know what? I don't want to be biomedical anymore. I want to be doing this. Like, and so I think blogging probably had a pretty big impact on me deciding to stop just working at, you know, the technician level and pursue a PhD. So, gosh, I can't even imagine what my life would be like if I hadn't started blogging.
It's like a self-discovery
yeah.
Episode in your life.
A little
bit. That's great. I didn't know that, and I'm happy to hear that, you know, because I haven't read every single one of your blog posts. I can't do that every day. Read everybody's posts every day, but I like to keep up because I, you know, we all know who you're going to read good stuff from, so, and you guys all fall into that category. Jeff, do you have anything else on your list of things here?
I do have a few more things, and one is one of my big hobby horses is bad science writing. Other people do too, and I don't like to attack it that way, but anyway, under the idea of bad science writing, the question is what makes for good science writing? And I keep thinking about this, and Janet Stemwedel, if I say it right, wrote the chapter on ethical considerations for science blogging, and she came the closest to me. So I have two quotations from her and then a comment. One, she said, two duties that should be uncontroversial are to be honest and to be fair. And then she said, be responsible to your story. And I immediately wrote down, what does it mean to get it right? Because I've come to the idea that writing for a non-technical person who cannot judge the truth of what you say puts you in a position of trust with that reader. And especially when we're writing as about something that can be as tortuous to navigate as science ideas, I finally come up. My prime directive is first, do not mislead. And I think that requires a certain precision and attention to detail, not necessarily sniffy academic writing. It can be a personal story, but you have to write carefully enough to try to help the reader not misunderstand what you're saying, and I think that's what it means to get it right. And so now I'm going to ask everyone, starting with Jason, who's still with us, what does it mean to get it right? What do you do that repays the trust that your reader puts in your writing?
Oh man, that's such a big question.
Yes.
I mean, I think you know, your first responsibility has to be to accuracy, like you said, and you know, some of these sort of ideas and ethics that come from journalism are things that, you know, I had to learn sort of on my own. You know, I did not go to journalism school. You know, I came from science, which also, you know, obviously prizes accuracy, but some of these ideas about how you verify things, you know, are things that you can learn from journalism and from journalists. So accuracy, but I also think, you know, second to that for me is keeping myself interested, you know, in terms of what makes good writing. So accuracy is obviously paramount. But the second thing is, if I'm bored, then my readers are going to be bored, I assume. So, you know, those two things, you know, with accuracy obviously being a little bit more important at the end of the day in terms of creating and establishing and maintaining that trust, I think are the two most important things to constantly be striving for.
Is there baggage that's a holdover from earlier days when science blogging was snarky critique and opinion? Opinion, you can say whatever you want, but if you're going to get close to journalism, we have to get close to accuracy and being right with our readers. Yes.
Well, you can still have opinion and do it in a sort of journalistic fashion, right? You can
be honest about it.
Right, and I think you know, it's important, the idea that a journalist is ever unbiased. I'd like to think that we're getting a little bit past that, and we're starting to get to a place where instead it's more important to be transparent about what your biases are. So, you know, I think there's still a lot of room, and I do it all the time, for, you know, injecting your personal voice and your personal opinions into your writing. Obviously, it depends on, you know, the outlet you're writing for. You know, are you writing for your own blog? Are you writing for a mainstream media outlet? Even if you are writing for a mainstream media outlet, it's possible that you can still, you know, depending on what they're looking for, you can still, you know, bring that opinion and bring sort of your own experiences to bear on a particular question. But I think there's still, and not only do I think there's still room for that, but I think it's quite important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I to follow up on what Jason was saying, I think there's lately become sort of the realization that being unbiased doesn't mean presenting every single angle mm-hmm. equally as if they all have equal merit. Mm-hmm. That's not really what unbiased means. Unbiased means, like in science, that you are willing to accept every possibility until the data tells you otherwise. Mm-hmm. So having all of those multiple hypotheses and getting to the point where you're rejecting that null hypothesis or you're rejecting these alternative hypotheses. And I think people, good journalists, do the same thing. I mean, really, the difference in good journalism in terms of the research and science of the research is it's just a sort of mechanism, whether or not you're pipetting or whether you're reading. And even in good science, you're reading, right? You're going through the literature. You're reading all of the previous experiments that have been done, mm-hmm. and you're saying, well, what results did they get, and what possible confounding factors were there to those results? You know, were they doing it, you know, in the sunlight, and the light might have had an effect, or whatever. So I think good science and good journalism actually look a lot alike in many ways. Mm-hmm. In the sense that you are being true and you are being honest and you're looking for the facts and you're mm-hmm. presenting them perhaps in a nice way, but or a pretty way or poetically, but your core goal in both is the truth and what is happening and reality, not sort of your own idea of what you want to happen. Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to be able and willing to trust our readers, our audience, that they are capable of distinguishing between the facts as we present them and the, you know, our own opinion, which is ideally derived from those facts. And if that's the case, if they can do that, and if we can trust them to do that, then there is space for them to come up to their own conclusions, even if they are different from ours.
Mm-hmm. Bethany, anything more on that?
I think they've basically got it. I hesitate to declaim because I personally don't feel like I'm an expert on you know what is you know journalism or you know even
I think
stuff
that's
like
a,
that.
That's a pretty trustworthy place to be, really.
Yeah, really. And this is exactly then why you ping so many people to contribute to this book.
How
right.
about, Joanne, I have two short quotations, and how about if I say those bits of advice, and then you can do the wrapping up that we like to do.
Okay.
I had two that I particularly like. One, Ed Yong gave us pretty much the best, I think, eternal advice for writers when he said, have something worth writing about and then write it well, which is almost as good as buy low, sell high. And I particularly liked... Rose Eveleth wrote Getting Interactive, talking about things that move and that you can push and stuff, which was a lot of fun. I'm paraphrasing, but her advice was to use shiny things, but not always.
Not everything needs to be a reaction GIF.
Not everything should be shiny or it all looks dull, I think.
Yep. And the as she said, yes, not that we don't all need to have cats. mean cats.
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
Well,
I mean,
a well-placed cat.
Occasionally well-placed cat. So before we wrap up quickly, is there anything you guys want to say that we didn't ask that, you know, you felt, whoa, why should people pick up this book? Anything.
It's free form here.
Free form at this point.
Well, I would just like to say, please, you know, the thing about books is that they take a long time to write, which means that by the time they're out, things have moved on and the
That's
internet
true.
Moves on very quickly, which is why we have a website. Yes, we have a website, and it's an awesome website. We are partnering with the Open Notebook, which is a website resource for writers, and we have a whole page on there with author bios. We also have the resources for each chapter, and there's Q&As that we are putting up every month with our authors, and that will continue as you know, as the world moves on, to make sure that the material in the book is supplemented so that it always stays current.
Yeah.
Right. We will put that at the bottom of the description here. So if people run across this discussion, they will find it. Thanks for letting us know. Christy?
I just think, I mean, as far as who should pick up this book, if you have even thought about writing about science on the internet, pick it up. It'll help you decide whether or not you should, if you haven't. If you already are, then pick it up, because there's stuff in there that I learned while editing the book where I was like, man, I never thought of it that way. Oh, I totally should be doing more of this, or I should, you know, try out this. So, yeah, I mean, there really is the whole point of pulling together the couple dozen authors that we grabbed was to make sure that there was something for everyone.
Right. And Jason?
Well, Christy stole what I was going to say. But I'll add that I think this, as far as we can tell, this is sort of the only science blogging specific handbook, guidebook, roadmap, field guide, whatever you want to call it. And I think as such, it's an important. I hope it becomes and remains an important piece, sort of in the history of science blogging. And so if for no other, you know, even if you think you have nothing left to learn about science blogging, which I don't think is the case for anyone, I think it's worth having this, you know, if you are interested in this community and in this culture, although to us, I think we feel like we've been at this forever, it's still very much a new sort of a new frontier for science writing and science communication. So I hope this remains an important part of that culture.
And I would also like to take a moment and say thank you, because without our funders, this could not have happened. The National Association of Science Writers gave us a very generous idea grant, and the Sloan Foundation also allowed us to do the great important thing of paying our writers, because bloggers should be paid.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, we really, really could not stress enough how much we thank our funders, both the Sloan Foundation and the National Association of Science Writers, for all their help and insights and the community they've offered.
That's wonderful. Well, it's definitely, even if you don't want to, you know, start a science blog, if you follow some of these people online, it might be interesting to hear more of what they have to say. You know, so, and it's sort of going to be this, as Jason mentioned, sort of this, it's sort of like holding history in your hands. You've got many of the key established players and pioneers in blogging who have written for this book. So I'd like to thank, first of all, everybody who tuned in to watch, for watching and for your interest, and most of all, thank you very much to our guests, Bethany Brookshire, Christy Wilcox, and Jason Goldman, and as always, my co-host, Jeff Schomeyer, and thank you all for tuning in to Read Science, and we'll see you again, very soon, right?
Yeah.
Bye.